Okay, so basically we are going to have a wrap-up session. Just I would like to sort of summarize a little bit what we're going to do. The idea of the workshop was to really bring people which are working both in various areas of strongly correlated electrons and electronic structure. And basically, the idea is that we had actually a very nice talk by Matthias Scheffler a couple of days ago, where he explained that if you want to describe materials, which is sort of the macroscopic things, we're here, but we have to have various techniques starting from the microscopic models to go to the mesoscopic scale and ending with the macroscopic, and in each part, in each range of length scales, one had to use different techniques. For example, here, density functional theory, while here we were using things like STATMEC or molecular dynamics. Now, our workshop was focused in a somewhat narrower area, and because we were working mostly on this microscopic side of strongly correlated of materials, and also we focused on a very specific area of materials which are correlated electrons. And correlated, and what's important is that even within this subset of all materials, we also need various tools, because even within this microcosm of material science, we have also different energy scales, and the degrees of freedom keep changing as a function of length scales. And given the complexity of these materials, we had to bring in various groups with expertise in different areas to try to map out the electronic structure of correlated materials. So that was sort of the idea of the workshop, and we had various things to try to attack this problem. We want to have simple pictures of what materials are doing. We want to have computational tools to be able to compute what's measured in experiments. We want to have tools to bridge between the different length scales, even within this microscopic realm. So we needed renormalization group methods. And we had various discussions. And we also need experiments to challenge the theorists as to what they need to approach. And all those elements were represented at various times in this workshop. We had various tutorials, we had various discussion sessions, and I think on the overall has been extremely successful. For this wrap-up session, what we thought to finish is with the participants that we have here, to have first a summary of some of the highlights of things that were done. That can only be a very partial summary, and Antoine George kindly agreed to do that. And then we send emails to the participants to present what they envision are going to be the directions of the future. So we're going to give everybody some small slot of time to discuss. And we're going to conclude with some pizza, which will be available hopefully around 12.
Only to those who contribute to the discussion.
Absolutely. Okay. So then without further ado, I hope that you all participate and interrupt at any point. This is really sure. Meant to be a very informal way of finishing this workshop.
Maybe we can turn off the light.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll try to do my best in giving Yeah, not too low.
Therefore, the screen is off.
Okay, so I'll try to do my best in summarizing some of the things that were discussed and taught and developed at this workshop, and trying also to emphasize perhaps some perspectives or frontiers of the field. Before I do any of that, though, I think I would really like to thank KITP in general for hosting this event. We're all very grateful that it could be organized here and very nicely organized. Dan Hoan was extremely supportive of the organization of the workshop. And our deepest thanks to KITP and also to all the participants and speakers at the workshop. Okay, so the thing I would like to mention again are basically the original goals of this workshop. As Gabby mentioned, this program basically brought together two communities. And these are two communities who actually work on very similar things when it comes to being interested in correlated electron materials, but who in the past have perhaps not talked to one another enough. And over the last few years, there's been a lot of technology transfer between these two communities, namely between the many-body theorist and the electronic structure theorist. And in the last 5 years, we've seen very, very nice progress at the boundary of these two fields, basically by having newly developed many-body techniques implemented within electronic structure calculations, and also by having some many-body theories trying to understand what the hell is going on in the field of electronic structure. So that was certainly the original idea of the workshop, to bring together these two communities, and not only to bring them together for discussions, but also hopefully to advance these theoretical methods at the interface between the two fields. And I think all the organizers were really convinced that, sure enough, there's been some theoretical progress, but the field of correlated electron materials remains to a large extent an experimentally driven field. So we can't have such a workshop without having a very, very strong experimental angle to it. And this is why an effort was made to bring basically each week an invited experimentalist who would report on the latest available experimental results. And as you will see in the rest of my talk, I will emphasize a couple of highlights that were, you know, fresh off the lab experimental material that was not disclosed before and that I think represented some quite exciting developments. In connection with these experimental talks, one of the goals of the workshop was also to develop some theoretical work, to advance some theoretical work here on specific material. And I'll also come back to that, advancing our qualitative and sometimes even quantitative understanding of those materials. And last but not least, I think one should mention that at this workshop, we are fortunate enough, and against that, thanks to the KITP facilities, to have several younger participants, affiliates, and young postdocs, and this certainly made the workshop a very active working environment. So the workshop also had a tutorial aspect for everybody. There's been a lot of tutorials on various topics. I'll try to mention some of those just to give an idea, even to the workshop participants who are here and haven't been staying for the whole program. So this was sort of the general idea. It had several angles to it. It had an angle on methods, an angle on materials, advancing all these things, but also having a tutorial aspect. So what I'll do in this little summary is to give an idea of the rather large variety of methods that have been discussed here, often presented in extended tutorials, then what I'll do is I'll highlight some of the exciting experimental results that were presented at the workshop. Obviously, this is a very personal selection, and I can, in 25 minutes, I can only pick a couple. I think there are many others, but I'll pick a couple of those. I picked them not only because of my personal taste, but also because they were more, perhaps, tight to some of the theoretical issues discussed here. And then I'll try to also make a very, very non-exhaustive list of some of the achievements from collaborative work that's been started or completed here, and then we'll move on to key open problem, directions, frontiers, and there, of course, we'll need the help of everybody in the room, basically. Okay, so methods that were presented in tutorials during the workshop, first of all, the electronic structure methods. I mentioned that this workshop brought together two communities. Obviously, the many body theories present here have made some effort over the past few years to understand some aspects of electronic structure calculations, but we need to learn a lot more. It's a complicated field, and so we needed these tutorials in electronic structure. We had very nice tutorials on downfolding. This is a buzzword which will come again during the talk and probably during the discussion, which has been one of the very much discussed electronic structure method during the workshop. This is basically, just in a word, a method to construct effective one electron Hamiltonians from DFT LDA, and to do it in a way that makes many body theories very happy, because it's a way to produce few localized orbitals and a very good descriptions of the bands in a limited range of energy. So it's really a way of abstracting a low-energy effective Hamiltonian from the full machinery of electronic structure, and that's really very, very useful. So tutorials, a nice tutorial was done on that by Ole Andersen, who is the father of this method, and various co-workers. We also had a sort of complementary approach from Peter Bloechel, who explained his projector augmented wave method. And this is a very promising method for electronic structure calculations because it sort of combines two worlds. It combines the worlds of plane wave people who really don't want to talk about localized basis functions except maybe at the end to analyze the results, and the world of localized orbitals. Basically, it's a method which uses localized orbitals in the spheres and plane waves between the spheres. And it's a very promising method, I think. As I mentioned later, there's been some work to by Peter Bloechel and Meb Alwani here to use this method for correlated electron materials. So these were electronic structure tutorials. There were also tutorials from the many body people present at the workshop. Of course, DMFT was one of the key techniques that were discussed. It was not the only one. There are many others. There were some nice tutorials presented on that. This is a sort of icon of what DMFT is all about, as Richard Scaletta is going to put it in a little song that he will reveal to us. Besides, don't look surprised. Besides DMFT, we had other routes for handling many body effects in either a model context or even a realistic context. We have lots of things. We had lots of discussions about quantum Monte Carlo methods. And I'm actually quite impressed by the developments of that field. We've had diffusion quantum Monte Carlo tutorials by Matthew Fulks, and also some very recent advances trying to push this method a lot further by Shiwei Zhang. We had some very nice things by Matthias Trier about Monte Carlo cluster algorithms. And Masa Imada also gave a tutorial and presented three or four new algorithms for correlated electron systems. Then there was a subgroup of people at the workshop who managed to came more or less all at the same period of time, which was a very efficient thing to do, who discussed renormalization group methods, recent advances in doing numerical normalization groups of fermion problems, and also contributed nice tutorials to the program. So then there were several other topics. I'm not going to bore you by listing everything. We had some fundamental aspects of DFT. We had some tutorial on frustrated quantum spin systems. And then we also picked a few sort of emerging fields, particularly active in terms of materials. For example, Shankar Dasarma came for a few days to talk to us about ferromagnetic semiconductors. And I think this was a very active, this was a very exciting talk. Okay, so now I'll sort of move to the second thing I wanted to say, namely to pinpoint some experimental highlights that were presented here more or less for the first time, either at the workshop or at the conference by invited experimentalists. And again, this is a very personal choice, and there were many others that were probably equally exciting, but I don't have time to review all of that. One experimental highlight that I found personally very, very interesting is that we learned from both Suga from Osaka and Jim Allen from the US that finally, in a strongly correlated metal, there is clear evidence for a nice quasi-particle peak near the Fermi surface. And this was something that, of course, is dear to our heart here because back about 10 years ago, there was a picture of what the spectroscopy, the one-particle spectroscopy of a strongly correlated metal close to the Mott transition should look like. We predicted that it should actually look like a three-peak structure with a quasi-particle peak near the Fermi level with reduced width, and at the same time, pre-existing in the correlated metal, lower and upper Hubbard band. This is a sort of icon that has been repeatedly used, for example, in this nice little logo I showed you before on my first transparency. And this was a very, very controversial point from the experimental point of view. In many systems which are correlated metals close to the Mott transition, people were doing photoelectron photoemission spectroscopy, and it was not at all clear that this picture was right or anywhere close to nature. For example, in this system, calcium strontium VO3, which is a system with one electron in a D shell, which is a very simple perovskite structure. The strontium compound is purely cubic. The calcium compound has a little bit of orthorhombic distortions in which the octahedra tilt, and that should lead to a little more correlation effects. So it's a sort of tunable system with D1 occupancy. It's always a metal. It doesn't order. It's a relatively correlated metal. And I'm going to show you a little movie of photo emission over the last 10 years, basically, to show you how much the field, and there I'm talking about the experimental field of photo emission, has progressed. So this was a very pioneering paper by Fujimori and many collaborators exactly 10 years ago, which showed photo emission spectroscopy, not angular result, angular integrated, for strontium VO3, the least correlated of these two metals, the one which has a purely cubic structure. And here you see the total density of states for negative energy, which was measured to be something like this. And this is compared on that plot to the LDA predicted density of states. So of course, you see two things on that plot. One thing you see is that, well, obviously there's need for a lot of theoretical work beyond LDA, because this is not exactly doing a very nice job at predicting the experimental spectrum. Qualitatively, you see that there is a dramatic reduction of spectral weight in the low energy region here as compared to the LDA prediction. So that's a nice low energy, low energy quasi-particle states with actually a very small value of the quasi-particle weight, apparently, and all that spectral weight has been transferred to the lower Hubbard band. So this is very nice. On the other hand, it's rather far from the picture, the cartoon I just showed you, because this peak is actually not much of a peak. It's just some sort of flattened thing, very depressed quasi-particles. And this even raises some experimental paradox, because from the point of view of specific heat, for example, this material is not at all a very correlated metal. It has a mass enhancement of 2 to 3, while this would say that the quasi-particle weight is 1/10 or something like that. So this would suggest a major theoretical problem with very strong k-dependence of the self-energy, for example, to explain that result. Okay, there was a little more detailed experimental study on the Hull series, calcium strontium VO3, a few years later. This is Inoue, 1995.
Well, this is angular resolved, right?
No, this is angular integrated. Okay, angular resolved is now coming on this material. This is a 3D material, so, it's a little harder. And basically, that confirmed that picture. This is low energy, 50 eV photons, photo emission results. So you see how going from strontium to calcium, you deplete a little bit the quasi-particles, you increase the lower Hubbard bands, and so on. Well, a few years later, an Indian group in collaboration with this Japanese group claimed they actually knew better and that this system had very strong bulk to surface difference. And that if you were doing photo emission spectroscopy, at higher photon energy, at many photon energy, you could actually try to deconvolute the bulk and the surface. And this is what they produced. This is the surface, and this is the bulk of strontium VO3. And what do you see here? Well, you see much less of a lower Hubbard band as compared to here, and much more of quasi-particle density of states. So this is starting to look more reasonable and also closer to the cartoon I showed before. What we've seen here at the conference is much more recent, fresh out of the lab, high photon energy, high resolution spectroscopy on this system. And this is the group of Suga in Japan. And see what has happened on this material. This is really the birth of this quasi-particle peak emerging from, finally emerging from surface contamination. So in 10 years, we've gone from there to there. And this is basically what we learned here on that subject. And this is also very good for some of the theoretical approaches that were developed in the past. This is actually a sort of simplified DMFT calculations of the spectrum that was completed during this workshop. Okay, this is what Sekiyama and Tsuga recently published on this compound. And now you see that's a comparison of LDA versus the experimental results. The picture has changed very, very much. LDA is still not doing a very, very good work, but at least it has the value of the density of states at the Fermi level right, and that's very important to be able to get away with a weakly k-dependent self-energy, while, of course, to describe the bandwidth reduction and the transfer of spectral weight, you need, to the lower Hubbard band, you need the many-body techniques that were the focus of this program. Just to continue on this D1 system, experimentalists are very active people. The same person, Isao Inoue, who was involved in these early photo emission experiments, went to Cambridge and did some very nice de Haas van Alphen experiment in the group of Lanzarich and Julian. And what they produced is a detailed mapping of all the sheets of the Fermi surface of this material, of actually calcium VO3, the most correlated of this series. And what this study has revealed, to some with some surprise, is that if you look at the Fermi surface, the orthorhombic distortion of this compound is more or less invisible. And basically, there is a very strong restoration of cubic symmetry in the Fermi surface, while in the crystallographic structure, the distortion is definitely there. That is something which is still the subject of theoretical work. There's been work here at the workshop by Sasha Poteriaev, Eva Pavarini, Zilke Biermann, and Sasha Lichtenstein precisely on this issue, using a more elaborated form of DMFT calculations in conjunction with the downfolded Hamiltonian to be able to map out this Fermi surface. And I think this produced very, very encouraging results to explain these experiments. Along the same lines, the quasi-particle peak that has been elusive for many years has also been revealed, and these are experiments that were disclosed for the first time when Jim Allen came here from, again, high photon energy photoemission experiments on V2O3. So this is how the quasi-particle peak is sensitive on photon energy in this material. So this was my first experimental highlight, the birth and rise of the quasi-particle peak, and also producing very encouraging results for the sort of approach developed at this workshop. Another subject that I personally found very exciting, and Ross McKenzie will talk more in detail about that, so I'll be pretty brief, are some very recent developments on molecular conductors, two-dimensional molecular conductors, which form these sort of triangular structures. One of the things we learned, actually, from private communications from André-Marie Tremblay at the very beginning of this workshop, is that the group in Sherbrooke, Fournier, Poirier, and co-workers, had observed a very strong anomaly of the sound velocity close to the Mott transition point of these materials. And of course, that was very exciting to us because some of the theories of the Mott transition do predict large compressibility near the critical point and strong coupling to the lattice. So since André-Marie was here in August, we were able to bring the guy who did the experiments here for the conference. So this also shows how things go at such a program and how theorists carry their experimental information. There were some theoretical calculations of transport using DMFT techniques that were performed at the workshop on these materials. The Mott transition is everywhere, and there were some very nice, and again, not yet published results that were presented by Denis Jérôme on 1D organics this time, that revealed that actually the behavior of this system, of these Bechgard salts, under pressure is really very, very much dominated by carrying the system away from the Mott transition as you apply pressure. And these are very nice high pressure results on these Faber salt, actually, which are free from many of the ambiguities of previous experiments having to do with the thermal expansion of the lattice. There were other experimental highlights that were, some of them were the subject of very active discussions. For example, we had two talks, one by Seamus Davies from Berkeley and one from Aaron Kapitelnik on Stanford, that revealed strong spatial inhomogeneities in cuprates, in the BISCO compounds, revealed by very beautiful STM experiments. And we had a very active discussion session led by Doug Scalapino on these questions. The data are very similar. The interpretation are very, very different between the two groups. So that made for some fun. We had some new optical data on iron silicide and relatively new optical data on cerium presented here by van der Maarle. We had some quite interesting points made by Sang-Woo Chong on the role of local clusters in frustrated magnets, basically telling us that in real life, what happens in many frustrated magnets is that the spin first try to arrange on some nanoscale structures, and then these structures do something on a larger scale, but that one has to think first locally. Then we also had during the conference some very intriguing aspects of orbital fluctuations, again in D1 perovskites by Bernd-Kaimer, raising interesting issues like the possibility of orbital liquids, which otherwise are, if they do not exist, very hard to understand the experimental rations. Okay, so now I'll sort of move on and I get a little bit away from experiment and try to mention some collaborative work that has happened during the workshop. Again, just very few things and only, of course, the things I'm aware of. It's very hard to disentangle this from actually the frontiers in the field. So, you know, you just go in the California hills and find some nice gold mine. So it's hard to really distinguish these things, so I'll sort of treat them together. Some of what I'm going to say is almost completed work, in some instances already submitted to CONMAT. In some other instances, it's work that has just started here. So there were some material-related issues, not to leave the field of materials. I mentioned several work already on D1 transition metal oxides by various people. In addition, there were several collaborations that took place on F-electron systems. This team of McMahon, Held, and Scaletta, who were working on cerium, combining electronic structure and DMFT, gathered here. Again, they coordinated their stay. And as far as I understand, they advanced their research, including spin orbit, which is probably important for this material, and deepening their understanding of the alpha-gamma transition. Sergei Savrasov and Gabi Kotlyar continued some work, some very interesting work on the role of phonons in plutonium. Since we're at material, I'd like to point out maybe some really interesting frontier things. From many things we learned from experimentalists here, it's becoming increasingly clear that in correlated electron material, spatial inhomogeneities plays a very key role. And these inhomogeneities are basically on some nanoscale. We see that in many, many materials. We see that in cuprates, but we also see that in these organics where antiferromagnetism and superconductivities coexist at low temperature. And we also see in all these materials very strong coupling to lattice degrees of freedom. So these are, of course, there are already theories that take this into account, but I'm sure that both of these things will have to play a big role in theoretical developments in the near future. And this is all connected to the fact, I think, that many, many phases are in close competition in strongly correlated electron, not only materials, but models. And that makes for the possibility of spinodal decompositions and things like that. Another very exciting line of research, I think, is about orbital fluctuations and orbital ordering, and in particular, orbital disordering. I'm absolutely convinced that looking at models in which there are strong orbital fluctuations is not only relevant for the practical life, but is also very relevant to see some new exotic physics like spin orbital liquids. That's another route to these exotic physics, very different from geometrical frustration, but maybe in somewhat closer contact to concrete materials. And maybe we'll hear about that more in the forthcoming workshop a year from now that Leon and others are organizing. What's interesting is that it may be the source of exotic physics, but it's probably also these orbital fluctuations, some of the underlying rationale for the successes of mean field approaches like the MFT. Because by shortening correlation length, you give a better chance to such approaches. Okay, another thing that I think some people have worked here and are quite interesting is the use of sort of common methods to handle interactions from the field of correlated electron materials to the field of mesoscopic conductors, Coulomb blockades, and so on. I think Paco Guinea will talk about that a little later. So these were materials. We've seen here also some advances on methods. So I mentioned some of these electronic structure methods at the beginning. There's been concrete work done at the workshop at combining these methods with many body and in particular dynamical mean field. There was a team of people making a happy marriage between downfolded Hamiltonians and DMFT. Al-Wani and Blochel started some work here using their PAW code and trying to implement DMFT in that. I think this is well underway. Serge Savrasov extended his full potential LMTO to what's called multiple kappas. All these projects were initiated and in some cases completed at the workshop. One work that was well underway before the workshop but got published and completed, I think, during the workshop is the elaboration of a code for realistic calculations of optical spectra that was worked by Udovenko, Savrasov, and Kotlia, who all came here. And this is very, very interesting and complementary to photoemission because optical spectra are something in which this bulk surface issue just, you know, doesn't apply. And what you are measuring is really the bulk of the material. So it's very challenging for theorists because you can't put the blame on experiments. And this was a spectrum just recently put on COMNAT of the optical spectrum of lanthanum TiO3. Other active topics at the workshop having to do with methods. We've seen lots of QMC. I think this field has seen recent progress, and a lot more is expected to come, including applications to concrete materials. We've seen some of that from Matthias Scheffler's talk. I hope Matthias might be able to contribute something towards the end of this discussion. But certainly, talks like the one of Shiwei Zhang gave some hope that you can do better and more with these methods in the near future. We've seen very large degree of imagination in pushing the frontier of numerical algorithms. Steve White embarked into combining some RG techniques with his DMRG and trying to attack quantum chemistry. I think quantum chemists should probably pay a lot of attention. This seems very interesting. And also a large crowd of people interested in the normalization group techniques for fermions gathered here more or less at the same period of time, and we're having apparently very, very active discussions and several joint work started among these people at the workshop. Okay, just to continue with frontiers and basically to conclude this summary, there are some directions that I think were also the subject of very active discussions at the workshop. One, I picked two of those that have to do with DMFT and electronic structure and issues in DMFT. One is the question of making the marriage between DMFT and electronic structure, or between many body and electronic structure, is starting to look like a happy marriage, but I think one can improve things, and many people feel that. In particular, can we elaborate an approach in which basically the screen interaction and the effective Hamiltonian will be constructed completely from first principle, starting, for example, from an RPA treatment of screening. So that's the so-called GW approximation. It's been very successful as a complementary approach, very different and complementary to DFT. It's been very successful to semiconductors. For correlated electron materials, it's clear that one has to go beyond and improve on the local components of both the self-energy and the effective interaction, for example, using extended versions of DMFT. And by that, I mean really that one tries to represent, it's a representability issue, one tries to represent the local components of the effective interactions by a generalized form of impurity problem. That was a subject of very active discussions during the workshop, and some collaborative work started. I'm sure there will be a lot more as an outcome of this discussion. This is a list of people, probably non-limitative, who were involved in this. This is a plot that was produced in the last few days of the workshop by Ferdi Ayasietiawan, which shows the local and nearest neighbor components of the effective screen interaction for nickel in some localized orbital basis, as obtained from GW, And as you see, this quantity is the local component of this effective interaction. It has very, very strong energy dependence. So if one wants to handle these problems, one has to deal with local problems, local impurity problems that have very strongly energy dependent U. And that's a challenge for the future. So this sort of line of research you know, may not be able to produce a life without U, but it will definitely produce a better life with a very strongly energy dependent U. That's sort of the punchline of this line of research. Another sort of frontier of the field, which is has been around for a few years, but I think again more will come, is about spatial correlations, and more precisely how these spatial correlations feed back into one particle properties. DMFT, for example, has of course ordered phases everywhere. It certainly handles the energy gain from ordering the system from a coherent arrangement of spins, for example. But what it doesn't have is the feedback of the local correlations into single particle properties when the environment is disordered, is not in the ordered phase. And in some cases, there is strong belief in the community that these effects lead to extremely strong k-dependence, in particular, perhaps a quasi-particle coherent scale that could be very different on different parts of the Fermi surface. These are speculations, even though, of course, hotspots, cold spots model are available already in the literature, and there are many experimental evidence, but this is certainly a challenge for concrete quantitative techniques. And one of the most promising way to go on this problem are the cluster extensions of dynamical mean field. And there's been active work at the workshop by many people in that field, ranging from the study of models, like the two-dimensional Hubbard model, to the study of materials, like some vanadium oxides, in which certainly one has to do more than single site and handle a vanadium dimer, at least, to be able to understand the physics. So that's about all I wanted to tell you. And again, I think we should all thank KITP very much. And we're going to hear more on many of these aspects in the talks that come now.
So, questions or comments on things that he missed or you would like to know?
I missed a lot of things, of course. I'm aware of that.
If not, Sasha Lichtenstein will say a few things about the current interface between electronic structure and many body methods. I remind you, those who don't participate won't get pizza, so.
Better ask questions.
Better ask questions.
Sasha, I need to put that on. We should have to come with one laptop, probably. Sorry. So Antoine made a perfect overview of the program, and I decided to just highlight one of the interesting collaborative work during this workshop, combining the NMTO, electronic downfolded electronic structure, and DMFT. There's a lot of collaboration going to this project, and main contribution is from Ole Andersen group, who produce a very nice downfolded LMTO program. Then Sasha Potyryaev, who really worked together with Eva Poverini and Sacha Dasgupta, with Zilke Biermann, to make this program working. So the general problem of embedding dynamical mean field in electronic structure is not easy. So there were a lot of attempts successful and unsuccessful, and I think now we have a very nice, at least simple tool to understand some realistic feature of the model, starting from this downfolded NM2 scheme. As already Antoine mentioned, so another alternative scheme was projected argument wave method by Peter. So Rasov also generalized his LMTO plus DMFT to full potential. So there are a lot of work going probably to what direction this life is out you. I think it's still future. I like it so much that you is cause a lot of trouble, I think, for different people. So dynamical mean field, don't need to discuss here. It's starting from very nice somehow idea of the self-consistent mapping of lattice model to quantum maturity model by Antoine and Gabi. So we need to combine it now with more realistic electronic structure. We don't want only some density of states, but real Hamiltonian for real system, which could describe some properties of, say, atomic interaction, atom-atom hybridization in solids, so on and so forth. So we want to start from real Hamiltonian, and the best, I think, way of downfolding the tons of spaghetti is NM2 method. You could downfold electronic structure to orthogonal Hamiltonian, which could contain just few orbital, maybe only d orbital, and then you apply DMFT for this Hamiltonian. So a few problems which we face. So first of all, even the local Green function or cluster Green function is non-local in some basis set. So we need to generalize the quantum Monte Carlo code, and first was done by Marcelo Rosenberg, and we generalized to arbitrary basis set. So we can work with matrix of local Green function. Also, we try to be as much realistic as we can on effective interaction vertex. So we somehow treat different Coulomb interaction, different Hund exchange rule coupling, so which takes our method more realistic. So, yes. This is a Hund rule coupling.
But it's not rotation
invariant. For specific model like T to G, if you apply this approximate condition that this U prime is U minus 2J, it's indeed rotational invariant in orbital space. There is small spin flip contribution coming from these terms, which we neglect. Okay, so we start from density functional description. For example, this is perovskite vanadite. So this is band structure, which theoretician doesn't like. It's a tons of spaghetti, which describe electronic hybridization in the crystal. And using the downfolded techniques, we can pick up the most interesting part of this electronic spectrum near the Fermi level. So of course this band is far away. It's oxygen 2p. This is unoccupied band. So what is important is so-called T2G band of vanadium. So this is located near the Fermi level, and we downfolded all higher energy electronic degrees of freedom to effective low line Hamiltonian. So and you can see this is in fact a two curve. One curve is a full calculation, and dotted curve is this NM2 downfolded. You hardly see any difference. So it's now a perfect method. So it was 50 years of experience in tight binding field, and it's heard talk by Dimitri Papakonstantopoulos, who is an expert. I think he's still somehow, this is the best automatical scheme.
So you fit the band structure?
There is no fitting. It's not, this is the point, there is no fitting. It's just a downfolding.
you downfolded a big, so Hamiltonian to small one. It's somehow straightforward procedure. You get an effective low-lying electronic Hamiltonian. Okay, then this is tight binding density of states, and you could do self-consistent this NM2 plus dynamical mean field, and you get renormalized band. So you see this big renormalization of quasi-particle in coherent path, which Antoine described. It's come from U is 4 electron volt, which is reasonable from no, you can calculate it from in this calculation, yes, but it's the same ballpark, so you could say that this is in reasonable agreement with constraint density functional calculation. And again, so you could use a renormalized band to obtain the Fermi surface. So the red one is LDA, the blue one is renormalized Fermi surface, and I think it can be a unique example, at least I believe, a very interesting. I tried to find for maybe last 5 years this method where renormalization can produce reasonable change in the Fermi surface. Normally, because of Leitinger theorem, volumes of Fermi surface, of course, conserved, but even the separate sheet of Fermi surface almost looks exactly the same like in one electron theory, density function. Here you see that some pieces of Fermi surface become smaller and some pieces become larger. So total volume is preserved, but there is a change in Fermi surface, say, volume and topology. And for example, you can see that some frequency which is existing in the Haas von Alphen experiments could be fitted only with a small radius of this orbit and not with Lightshed and LDA. So this.
What happens to the masses?
So we still need to be calculated. So it's just a very recent example. Yeah.
On this plot in the left corner, I mean, bottom left.
It's experiment.
Yes, but you know, the vertical axis, there is frequency, right?
This is frequency and this is angle. Of,
angle.
Yeah.
Rotation of
a. Yeah. So this is normal. The first one.
So the gray bands are experimental data, right?
The white grade experimental, the dotted line is LDA, which is not consistent with experiments, and this full line is some tight binding fit, which they claim that they can reproduce experiment. And interesting enough, this tight binding fit is very close to undistorted lattice. So this lattice has a large orthorhombic distortion. And if you do a very simple fit, adjust the parameter to cubic, then you can perfectly fit the Haas von Alphen experiment. So it seems to me that effect of lattice distortion and effect of correlation is just cancel each other. So it means other way, correlation effects just reduce a distortion.
With the LDA calculations, do the masses of the LDA account for the specific heat of the if you take the Haas von Alphen orbits,
some
of the masses
that
account for the specific heat.
I don't think so. Probably not.
Yes, a question. Mm-hmm. I think how the correlation seems to change the distortion. Mm-hmm. This method really does the first principle electronic structure to recalculate all the bands.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's possible to put in elastic energy or some more logical description of the band structure and get this effect just by comparing the elastic energy and the correlation energy?
What was it? I probably could do some very simple estimation, but you know, in this case you need an anisotropic shift of the band. So few bands should go up and few. So it's you need to preserve the total volume of Fermi surface and change the separate topology of Fermi surface. So it's non-trivial. So it can be only if the self-energy is a matrix. And moreover, diagonal element of the self-energy, real part, has a different sign. I'm not sure that you could do this in this simple estimation.
What is the scale of the distortions? I mean, if you want to put some energy scale, on which energy range of are we talking about here? Like, to quantify that, there's some parameters in your body structure, there's some hoppings which are responsible for the distortion. How large are they, those matrix elements?
No, but in terms of hopping or in terms of energy?
In terms of hopping, just to get an idea of the effect.
I think the largest hopping, if let's say of order of half electron volt. So
no.
Half electron volt is a scale.
That I know.
Okay, and distortion is 0.1, I would say. So 10%. Oh, maybe 10%. I would say 0.1.
And are there local experiments which see distortion, or they don't see it locally?
X-ray. It's X-ray.
I just want to know whether it's that the distortion we normalize mm-hmm. away at very low energies, so it's only the Fermi surface which looks undistorted, or also on high energy range. And so what does a local probe see? And
so if your question is if it's a dynamical distortion or it's a static.
No, I just want to know experimentally what's known. I mean, mm-hmm. is it on a high energy scale? Do you see the distortions?
Yes. So there is really distortion in the lattice and
okay. It's important to check that a high frequency or effect goes away. That it's only at low frequencies that the symmetry is restored.
Yeah. But probably for higher frequency, it's a very small effect. So.
That
so you want to say that Hubbard band should split? Yeah, it's a small effect, of course, because it's incoherent. Okay, so the same technique and the same method we could apply for even for cluster, because the QMC in multi-orbital basis is somehow perfectly suited for treating of clusters. So this was, again, cluster in V2O3. You have a pair of atoms. So we map this model for two-side cluster with a three orbital per side in the box. So that was work by Sasha Potyryev. Again, we start from LDS band structure. We downfold it to T2G band. It's again perfect fit, which is red and green line on top of each other. So this is T2G bands only. So this effective one electron T2G orbital, so we can just extract the parameter of different hopping and trigonal distortion, which is also important characteristic of electronic structure. We could visualize this NMTO orbitals. So this is effective orbitals A1G and 2T2G. This is two vanadium atoms. You see that it's a very big overlap between vanadium pair, and it's not perfectly atomic orbital. You see, this is some contribution of oxygen. It's really like molecular orbital. And again, we can calculate electronic structure in metallic phase, insulating phase, compare the single site and cluster. So it's turned out that the cluster effect increased the tendency towards an insulating. It's interesting to compare different materials. So Gabi proposes comparison of T2O3 and V2O3. It's a classical Goodenough diagram. And it's interesting, there is different orbital degrees of freedom involved. So in titanium with D1 configuration, it's only A1G orbital which is occupied, and you have a gap, small gap. So this is all T2G states, but this is this trigonal distortion, A1G and EG part. While in vanadium, it's mainly EG and a little bit of A1G. And you can see this because mainly occupied orbital in V2O3 is A and E, and A1G is unoccupied. So if you compare these results with titanium 2O3, then you see that it's again consists with good enough diagram. First of all, we get insulating solution with a very small gap, and gap is between A1G and EG mainly, and this gap is order, say, experimentally is 0.2 electron volt, very small gap. And moreover, you could easily see that this cluster effect also increase tendency towards the gap forming.
Can I ask, I'm sorry, it's too obvious, but these cluster calculations have been compared with the single set calculations, say, just on the Hubbard model and with exact results,
Right. No, but this is Hubbard interaction with...
I know. I'm asking whether the model calculations showing how much better the cluster does compared to a single site.
Yeah. There is a model calculation of, say, double beta lattice, and you could see...
I guess your question is single site EMFT versus cluster EMFT.
For model. I think that perfect model in this case is just maybe
the ferromagnetic correlation.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. Short range interferomagnetic correlation you could capture, but in fact this is
for models, not for real.
For models. Yeah.
For models within 1D.
Uh-huh. How about the character of the mode transition, which in the single set case is very specific and has human condition and mass diverging? Has this been studied systematically if you go to cluster, how just the, in terms of the approach to the transition, how that?
Not yet, no, I would say. But if you could see here, this is exactly the case, because probably because of dynamical interferomagnetic correlation, you have a very small this interferomagnetic gap in paramagnetic insulating solution.
But again, a very important point. We all know that if we look at sufficiently low energy, they have to be the cluster effects and the single site should be completely different. But for real materials in the parameter range where things are, there's not much difference. So that's sort of the situation.
No, but somehow you see that you just increase the tendency towards the gap if you compare.
It's
effect of order of t squared over u. It's
at low energies, we know that things have to change really dramatically if you could probe it with enough resolution. Low temperatures, closer to the transition.
Oh.
I don't remember the details, but Mark has this nice study of the dynamical.
Cluster.
The D wave current correlations as a function of this cluster size.
Yes.
I assume that has DMFT, the single site problem there as well. So that would be a place to look for model calculations.
But yes, for.
So there's more than one way to generalize DMFT to clusters. I was wondering how much is that understood. Good.
Yeah, we know that not all animals are equal.
But that's what's quite important, what I'm saying, that if you take a material like V2O3 or titanium-03 or some random thing that you take the parameters from nature, the difference is between, you should show, for example, such as a single-side EMFT for V2O3 and the cluster for V2O3. The differences are not very large, I see. Or if you're studying at high temperature, for example, we spent a lot of time looking at cluster studies of the Hubbard model at high temperature. So you can compare two sites and four sites and one site.
Okay.
So in the temperature range that the Monte Carlo likes to work, like the beat equals to 32, the non-local part of the self-energy is small.
Okay.
And the things are very similar. On the other hand, it's completely clear that if you really push things, if you really lower the temperature, if you go, then you should see dramatic differences. Like Richard is pointing out, in a plaquette you can have D-wave superconductivity, in a single site you can't. So eventually, also there are many analytic arguments why, as you get close to the transition, you have to start seeing strong K dependence. So that's the way things are. So I would say for many practical things for studying materials, in the parameter range that people are measuring, the single site of the cluster is probably okay. But if we want to push things to where where at least I would like to go, I mean, a lot more work is needed.
Okay.
I think we need Ha in the feed because he's asking all the right questions.
Okay.
So I've got an L because, well, I'm told now because we're going to talk about this poison.
Sure.
Go ahead. No problem.
Do we have a objection? There is an order?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Low-tech solution. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is how the questions that are coming up here about particularly generalizing dynamical mean field theories and clusters, how they relate to real materials, and particularly there's these organic materials that Antoine mentioned. I'm going to talk about two sort of different classes of organic materials. There's several families involving this ET material where they're quasi-two-dimensional. And this is a schematic phase diagram of temperature versus pressure. And so what you see is there's a strong competition between superconductivity and there's a first-order phase transition into an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. But above here, you do have a Mott insulator where there's no long-range order, but it's insulating. And you see here a well-defined crossover from something that's very close to a Fermi liquid to basically an incoherent or a bad metal. And Antoine Georges mentioned these nice acoustic anomaly experiments from Canada, from Sherbrooke, that clearly showed this anomaly. Now, if you look at what the electronic structure of these materials looks like, there's actually a class of three different families that I believe can be described by the following Hubbard model, where basically you take a square lattice and you have hopping only along one diagonal, and this model is always at half filling, and the relative size of the diagonal hopping T prime to T can be of the order of between 0.2 and 0.1. That's from quantum chemistry. Now, what's very interesting is that if you do dynamical mean field theory on this model, this is roughly what you would get. So now here we're taking, if we're taking U on T, we put in some level of frustration, we look on U on T, and so we'll see a Fermi liquid, we'll see this well-defined thing, crossover or coherence temperature, and we actually calculated before those experiments were done in Sherbrooke, we actually did calculate acoustic anomalies occurring at that temperature. And so the thing is, given this similarity, the question is, you know, why does dynamical mean field theory capture this so well, particularly given this is a 2D system? And so I think the question is, if you start going from a single side approximation to looking at some sort of cluster, what's going to happen to this phase diagram? I mean, particularly, is the Mott phase going to, you know, stay there, or is it going to get suppressed, and so that you'll only have insulator when you have anti-ferromagnetic ordering? And then I think the other big question is whether, if you have like a four-site cluster, will it really give superconductivity? Now, I'm not going to talk in a minute about a different class of materials. Any questions about that? And you're trying to do this, right?
Well, it's a very hard problem, and I think that Olivier Percolet, I think more or less, has set up things so as to be able to address this. And again, I mean, it's not obvious because once you go to the cluster, you start, the anti-ferromagnetism really hits you. So it depends in a very strong way how much frustration you have.
Right.
So I think the answer is positive. Still to be seen.
Okay.
I have a couple of remarks on this. I certainly agree with this outcome, with the multi-like approaches. I think in the experiment, as I mentioned in some private discussion with you, there's been some very precise transport measurements trying to map out these things. It's very interesting to see that this picture coming from single side DMFT does a pretty good job outside the critical region. Within the critical region, within
when we say
hysteretic region.
Right, here,
hysteresis lines like this, then it's completely clear from the experiments that one needs a lot more theory. And I'm pretty sure that again the physics of local phase separation is playing a very, very important role in that regime. So, you know, deep inside the critical region, I think there's room for a lot more.
Okay, so then not all organic superconductors are the same, and there's a whole second class of materials that I've been looking at the last few years. And basically this theta materials, beta double prime materials, the chemists have got all sorts of combination of anions and donor molecules. Again, they're layered structure. But schematically, you've got this phase diagram. You've got temperature, and then you've got pressure. Now, depending on the material, pressure could be going this way or that way, or you could be changing the anion, which will change where you sit on the phase diagram. But I think there's a fairly universal phase diagram where you've got a metal, then you've got a charge ordered insulator. At a much lower temperature, you've got antiferromagnetic ordering, and then you see superconductivity near some sort of quantum critical point. Well, again, if you start with the quantum chemistry, I think the rudimentary model that's consistent with this is where you take an extended Hubbard model on a square lattice, and you have a nearest neighbor interaction, and then you have, you can just take U to be infinite, and you're sitting at quarter filling. And again, this is all consistent with the quantum chemistry. Now, if you look in the strong coupling region, basically the ground state's going to be a charge-ordered insulator, where you'll have this checkerboard ordering. And the other thing that's interesting is you see any ferromagnetic interaction due to an exchange process around the ring. Now, what we did was with slave bosons to order 1 on n, we basically found this phase diagram where we got a metal, we had charge ordering, and we had DXY superconductivity. So again, that's qualitatively consistent with the experimental phase diagram. But again, you know, this is slave bosons to leading order in 1 on n, and n is 2. So it'd be nice to have other kind of calculations. And I think a fundamental question is the following, is we know that up here we've got a charge-ordered insulator which is antiferromagnetic. And we know down here we're going to get a metal. And so the question is, does the charge ordering, the antiferromagnetism and the metal insulator transition, are they all occurring at the same quantum critical point?
Is it even clear that this is a critical point as
not
the first
order? Well, that's also true. In slave bosons, it is a quantum critical point. But yeah, no, that's certainly something to, that needs to be looked at. Yep. So, okay, we could change that to just what's the ordering of the transition.
Yeah, no, on the
theory,
you wouldn't expect the different
orders
necessarily occur at the same place. This is very unnatural at
Wonder
level, right?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's right. So this is a totally open question of where, and also where do they, so if the antiferromagnetism occurs here, that's good news for our slave boson calculation because basically the superconductivity is mediated by charge fluctuations. But if it's occurring on the other side, then there's a problem. Okay.
You don't have the spin ordering in the slave boson calculation.
No. So, and then the other thing that I think where cellular or clustered DMFT could do a nice job is just to do a two-site. Look at the problem from two sites and just to see whether you can actually get the charge ordering in that. Okay, so there's basically, I think there's these two broad classes of organic materials, and I think it ties in very nicely with these issues of, well, basically why does the MFT work so well and capture so much of the physics? Okay.
Question.
Yep.
Yeah, you said that in the first class that it was strictly half-filled and that this class was strictly quarter-filled.
Right.
Then Antoine made a remark about inhomogeneity, so I wanted to ask, what is the justification for assuming that there is no doping or
The chemistry is that you get very good charge transfer from one electron from a pair of these organic molecules gets transferred completely to the anion. So you're always stuck with half a hole per organic molecule.
And so any phase separation that would occur would be between two phases which have exactly the same filling.
I think so, but I can't tell you that that's experimentally definitely proven. But do you want to say anything about that? Is that?
I have no idea.
Okay. Is the first order transition? Not that I'm aware of, no. But again, I think that's pretty open.
I wasn't clear what features of this are experimental.
Oh, okay. Well, what's established experimentally? Roughly, schematically, that's what's established experimentally. But it's not. Yeah, that's. There's basically several materials that you can map onto a phase diagram that looks pretty much like that.
Can we put our finger and say, here, where are the strong correlations here? You can get this from spin fluctuation theory as well, this kind of phase diagram very easily.
Well, not with charge ordering, can you?
Also, not in character of the superconductivity. We had a talk by Shmalian in the workshop in which he tried to get the superconductivity from small U, which apparently predicts the wrong symmetry. So the large U.
For spin fluctuations, will give you something that looks like that.
Well, in spin fluctuations, you can put lots of charge fluctuations in there some recounted way. Spin fluctuation, but it's an RPL-like scheme, which is always phenomenological at some level.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, and Doug Scalpino did this years ago. Well, I think maybe Jorge, you were on that paper too. Yeah, with a three-dimensional. So previous life, right? Yeah. No, they got DXY. Yeah, they got DXY too. When they had the charge ordering. I don't know. Oh, but that's a different class of materials. That's one thing we've got to keep making sure. There's two classes of materials, yeah.
Yeah, in these materials, is anything actually known about the pairing state?
No, not, no. This one, no. It's not known what it is. These one, there's all sorts of people who claim it's D-wave, people who claim it's S-wave, numerous experiments. Right, yeah. This one, what I'm saying is, this one there's more experiments that in principle could tell you what it is. The other one, no, there's no experiment.
Do you have any feeling, because you also say if you use the Dooley Hubbard model here, just like in the Cooperets, you don't have that diagonal hole.
Right.
What would be the main difference? Why is there we don't have a super gap phase here?
Oh, you're getting close to the bone here. What? Yeah, that's a very good question, and why... there's a first order transition. Do you want to say your answer? Okay. Well, but it's very weak. It's not.
Is it tiny or is it huge?
There's a small pseudo gap seen sort of here. But see, there isn't. What he's saying is there's nothing in here. There isn't a pseudo gap in there. Okay.
I know many people are trying to say, this looks like the two-phase. One thing should be kept in mind. The resistivity of these materials, even in the metallic phase, is a lot worse than the two-phase. These are not very good metals. I think that makes a very big difference.
At low temperatures?
At intermediate temperature, where the action is taking place. Even the system becomes superconducting when the sheet resistance is just about one quarter of the quantum of resistance.
I disagree with that, yeah.
Well, that's what Inoue says,
I know, I disagree. Because you see, the beautiful, the Hafsan alpha, so you've got to have a wall.
We have to ask experimentalists.
Yeah, I think that this question really is.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's
we shouldn't with
keep all confident to using the same model.
Right.
But I mean, that should make us,
But we're not.
So we're not, that's the whole point.
We are not, that's the whole point.
The T prime.
It's not just the T prime. Well, I mean, it depends on which energy range, right? In intermediate energies, probably you should use a model with copper and oxygen with a J which is not related to U. I mean, I believe that the essential physics of the cuprates is that because of this extra path that you have to make your super exchange, your J happens to be somewhat larger than in those organics, which are much better described by the one-band model, and therefore, as a result, have a smaller J, they're more frustrated, and that's what allows you to see this first-order transition. So,
also, don't forget, these guys are not doped. They are not doped. If you were able to dope them, MOSFETs, maybe you would see very interesting physics.
Yeah, but probably will be different from cuprates because the parent compounds are different from cuprates. Therefore, the doped material will also likely be different.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that I have enjoyed it a lot here. I mean, this has been an excellent workshop, very, very interesting. And I'm going to tell you about possible developments of dynamical mean field, but in a very different direction from the ones discussed so far, and that is towards more mesoscopic systems. And we all know that the dynamical mean field method revolves about the idea of replacing the whole system by an effective Anderson impurity, correlated impurity. And of course, in mesoscopics, there's the equivalent of the Anderson impurity, and that is the quantum dot. So the thing is to go beyond the understanding we have of a quantum dot towards systems made of many quantum dots, I mean, which I will describe shortly. And quantum dots can come in two ways. You can have either a metallic quantum dot in which you have a very close level spacing. So basically, you have a continuous density of states within the dot. Of course, the equivalent of the correlation of the U term or the Hubbard term is the charging energy. And then you have the conductivity between the dot and the external lead. And these are so basically your parameters are the conductivity and this counterpart of the Hubbard term. And then you can have in the opposite situation when the level spacing is very large, much larger than the temperature the experiment is being performed at, you have this very much the extreme situation, the opposite situation, in which you basically are looking to isolated levels within the quantum dot. And this case is very well understood, the metallic quantum dot. I mean, they're beautiful experiments, and this reference I have here from 98 just wraps the whole thing up. And then theoretically, actually, it's also very well understood. You describe the quantum dot in terms of a phase. And actually, it's a nice work which was done here by three brilliant postdocs, here in Edison Hall, way, way back, Emil Motola, Gershon and Eshel Ben-Jacob from very different backgrounds. After that, it's known that the effective charging energy is renormalized because of the virtual fluctuations of the electrons in and out of the dot, and that was also worked out. And the last straw was added by Leo Glassman, where he discussed co-tunneling effects at very low temperatures. But basically, there is a good agreement between experiments and theory, and the metallic quantum dot is pretty well understood. Then, in the late 90s, there was a big competition trying to find the Kondo effect in quantum dots. It was known to be there, but you had to go to this limit, which is much more difficult to achieve experimentally than this other limit. You have to have huge level spacing, so you have to go to the milli-Kelvin temperature and so on. the race was won by the MIT people, and shortly afterwards, people in DERF basically found the same thing. And here, I have not reported the theoretical developments, because basically what people did was to take everything which was known about the Kondo effects and just use the parameters appropriate for quantum dots in this regime. So, I mean, there is nice theoretical work, but basically it's a rephrasing of what is known about the Anderson impurity model. So this is a present status, a very, very brief sketch of what's going on in quantum dots. So what's the obvious generalization? It's granular systems. I mean, there are a lot of experiments in granular metallic systems of many types. And in all of them, if the grain size is sufficiently small at very low temperatures, the resistance goes up. And it took the experimentalists time to realize that they were actually observing Coulomb blockade effects. But right now, it's very much assumed. And what you have at the end using the theory, I mean, for the metallic grains, the theory I mentioned to you before basically describes everything happening within the grain, Coulomb blockade effects, and so on, in terms of a collective phase. And this is the action for the granular system. So you have, I mean, there's a phase for each grain, there is a Coulomb energy for each grain. I'm neglecting intergrain Coulomb energies, which may be relevant, and there is some coupling, some dimensionless coupling between grains. But basically, it's the conductance expressed in units in the quantum unit of conductance. And there may be offset charges, which are like topological terms. So this is a truly many-body system, but it's very well suited for the dynamical mean field theory, which is what we did. So, yeah.
What is the physical meaning of this phase phi?
The way historically it started superconducting systems, and then it's the extrapolation of the superconducting phase to a normal system.
What is that?
It's the conjugate to the charge. You have only collective variables left. One is the charge, and then it's a quantum variable. That's the whole point. It can fluctuate.
Because it sounds like, you know, basically the description of a superconducting system. I mean, if I had
superconducting
system, it would be exactly the same.
No, you will get superconducting grains if you add just some coupling. I mean, if you take out the charging effects and you look at the phase will fluctuate, will never be pinned like in a superconductor. This kind of long-range interaction between phases at different times is not strong enough to pin the phase. So in that respect, this system is not describing a superconductor.
Because its cosine term looks like yours, but it's in different times.
Yeah, because e to the I phi is the operator which creates a unit of charge, if you think of it.
How do you relate it to Hubbard model? You have only two states, you get a Hubbard model, right? If you have many states, then you get this, isn't that right?
I'm not saying that.
It's like a harmonic oscillator which has many states, right?
It's not exactly an harmonic oscillator. I'm not saying that this is like the Hubbard model. I'm saying I started from systems with physics similar to the Hubbard model. But here you are allowing for charge fluctuations of many sizes, of many values, not just 0 and 1.
Yes, so it's like the general Hubbard model.
That's what I'm coming to. It's not degenerate because you have a full band inside. So every time you add an electron, it doesn't need to go directly to the Fermi level. It can go some energy up, and then you can take the energy, you can take another electron from below the Fermi level. So you can create electron hole excitations within the grain, which is something which doesn't happen in the Hubbard model, obviously. Okay, so, and then as I said, you have this topological term, which implies, I mean, this we have solved by different ways. One of them is Monte Carlo, and actually, doing in dynamical mean field, and actually this it looks like it's a bosonic theory, so it will have no sign problems, but topological terms are always complicated, and they lead to sign problems, which anyway can be solved. Now, there is a clear example of convergent evolution, because starting from the Hubbard model, Serge Florence and Antoine George worked out a related model, which is exactly what you were mentioning, and that is large grains with huge degeneracy inside. And then you can include the constraint of, you can allow for the fact that the charge has to be equal to the number of grains by kind of Lagrange multiplier, and in that way you put a quantum rotor at each grain. And basically, you recover this model. I mean, the philosophy here was more slave bosons, and here the philosophy was superconductivity. But as I said, at the end, except for the fact that the spectrum within this grain, these grains here, is degenerate, and the spectrum within these grains is not degenerate, the two models look very much alike.
As Antoine said, this is...
You can put the break the genus in Habermas just by putting on-site term, right, on-site.
Well, you can break the genus by hand. You can allow, I mean, you can put a any spectrum you can think of inside this plane, which is actually what we are doing now. And then, actually, you have this. The opposite limit could be to, I mean, here we have a phase-only description, no quantum coherence of the electrons. Here there is a mixed description in which you have electrons and phases. And here you have, I mean, it's a related problem in which the phase is gone and you only have the electrons. But some of the physics, I think, is the same, because basically the disorder is playing an important role in all these problems as well. Yeah, well, that's important indeed. Okay, so now let me start concluding. So let me discuss open problems. First of all, there is a standard theory for these effects due to Hellman and Abeles way back in 76, and according to which the resistance should go like 1 over the square root of the temperature, so it's not truly what we found in this work we posted recently on dynamical mean field for this system was a real insulating system. I mean, this granular system became insulating at very low temperatures. Experiments are much closer to a law like this, which is less insulating. I mean, this doesn't go like 1 over T, which is the expected behavior in a truly insulating system. And I have checked that, and we have tried to compare to experiments. This does much better. So to start with, there is here a kind of a very unsatisfactory situation from a theoretical point of view. The theory here, which is outlined here, is just assuming that you shunt everything by a given junction, and then the length of the junction is proportional to the radius of the grains involved, and from that you get immediately this law. So it's another way of reducing the problem to a single junction, so to speak, or a single grain. But so this theory, to me, cannot be superior to a theory in which you include Coulomb blockade effects in much more detailed way, and you include many grains and put disorder and whatnot. So how come that this theory works better than kind of dynamical mean field-like theory for the same system? To me, this is a challenge, and there should be some answer for that, but should be eventually found. Now one can discuss the role of disorder. The disorder in the couplings is something which is trivial to deal with in a dynamical mean field, because after all, dynamical mean field is a much more extended version of coherent phase approximation, which was in the first place set up to deal with disorder. And the same thing can be done about disorder in the charging entities. You can, using the ideas of the coherent phase approximation, you can include these things. Also, it has not been done, and equally in these offset charges. Then it's the second question you ask. I mean, in a granular system, there are no reasons to expect that coupling, electrostatic couplings between grains are much smaller than the intra-grain coupling. So you definitely have to deal with extended, I mean, you have to take into account this extended dynamical mean field theory in order to do a good job.
Can they actually see some non-trivial dynamics in the experiments if they have a granular?
Sorry?
If they have a granular system like this, have they seen some non-trivial dynamics, classic dynamics, or anything like that?
Not that I know of. However, I have the suspicion that this could be somehow related, but I'm not sure. Now, the second thing is that once you have, I mean, when you deal with, metallic grains with a phase only, basically you lose the phase coherence of the electrons. But if you put on the same footing the electrons and the phases, then you can analyze whether you will get metallic coherence at very low temperatures or not, which is a kind of interesting thing. I mean, you can go beyond the standard theory of Coulomb blockade by looking at the electrons themselves. Then in the experiment, there are many open questions. For instance, in magnetic granular materials, it happens often that the effective charging energy depends on the magnetic field. That's not what you would expect, because the charging energy, the capacitance, is a geometric property of the system. The only thing is that, of course, if you add fluctuations in the charge, that is, if you add
virtual hoppings between electrons here and there, your actual charge cloud is bigger, and that will reduce the charging energy. So it's a many-body effect, which, and I mean, the magnetic field is also changing the conductances between grains. That definitely can do. So probably it's because of the interplay between the influence of the magnetic field on the conductance and the fact that the effective charging energy depends on the conductance that you will get this. But that should also be worked out. And then, of course, there are many experiments on granular and superconducting granular systems, and the description I have mentioned to you is very well suited for that. You only need to add the Josephson coupling. And just let me finish to be in a more speculative way. I mean, a nice recent development of Coulomb blockade ideas was done by Yuri Nazarov, Andrei Saikin, and Dima Golubev recently, and they looked at the problem not of a weakly coupled grain to a lead, but they looked at the problem of a very strongly coupled system with many channels with arbitrary transmissions between the system and the channel. And basically, you get the same effect. So to speak, it belongs to the same universality class, except when the transmission through one of the channels is exactly one. But otherwise, this strongly coupled system can be described in the same, I mean, has the same physics as the almost isolated grain I mentioned to you before. And that, of course, opens the door to a nice idea. I mean, if you combine this with a dynamic Almian field, what you're describing is no longer a granular metal, but a dirty metal, because now if they connect, I mean, you can divide a dirty metal into pieces of the order, more or less, of the elastic mean free path or whatever, then they will be strongly coupled. But you can deal with the Coulomb interaction in a very different way from the usual way it was done before. I mean, now you can include an interaction between all the electrons within each grain and see what happens, using, of course, extensions of this calculation in dynamic Almian field. And of course, you have to, it's better to keep the electrons, because at very low temperatures, you will go to temperatures below the level spacing within these blocks. And then if you want to understand those temperatures, then definitely the electronic degrees of freedom have to be put back into the model. And that makes contact with a recent polemic, which a very heated polemic, and that is whether there are defacing effects or not at zero temperature in dirty metals. I have my own opinion. I tend to agree with the standard view that the defacing rate tends to go to zero. But these people, and Gershon too, emphasize very strongly that all these calculations are a kind of self-consistent perturbative calculations, and it will. And they claim that if you go beyond that, then you can find defacing. And this is precisely a nice way of doing that. Actually, this is a method that, from what I have told you, is biased towards the insulating phase. So at least you can get a negative result. If you get a metallic phase, nevertheless, then you're contradicting these theories of defacing in a really big way. If you get an insulating phase, then you don't know, you're somewhere in between. But you should do more work. But
I thought that in the Schuler and other theories, then the self-energy is strongly momentum dependent, etc. Whereas in the game of is the opposite. So how can these two phenomena be related by the same philosophy?
No, I'm not saying that this method has anything to do with the Altschuler method at all. I'm saying this is an alternative way of looking at coherence effects in dirty metals at very low, or can be, and this is all speculation. It can be an alternative way of looking at coherence effects in dirty metals at very low temperatures from a completely different starting point.
Maybe a capturing different physical processes also. That is
possible. As I said, I couldn't be surprised if you manage to carry this thing all the way to the end, you will get insulating phases, but which will contradict this theory in three dimensions, which is precisely when the dynamical mean field scheme should work. I don't know, but so then you have to do something else. I mean, but But as I'm saying, this is a completely alternative, different approach, which may help to shed light about the low temperature behavior of a very dirty metal. That's it. But this, as I said, I just wanted to put some, in the spirit of this meeting, some speculative ideas at the end. I think that's it.
Now, are other questions on this? So now we wanted to have a look at electrons and follow up on full space, something about the electron structure.
Is anybody going to use this anymore? Probably not.
F electron systems are different from anything which we sort of discussed before, in the sense that they have localized states. That makes it very different from the other systems. And the traditional way of doing electronic structure calculations.
Just repeat what you said. Okay. We are not recorded. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Is it now? F electron systems are different in the sense that they have localized states, and those localized states do affect a lot of the electronic properties. And the traditional approaches to calculate electronic structures, so the band theory approaches for F electron systems, were an F core calculations, where one put the F electrons in the core and one treated the sp dnf electrons as valence electrons. However, for the rare earths, one was using the 5Fs instead of the 4Fs as the expansion wave functions, or one treated the Fs in the local density approximation as band electron. One used those two approaches, and then we compared with experiments. So we could say if the F electron participated to the Fermi surface or not. And the outcome of all those calculations, which happened over a decade or more, was depending on the systems, all possible variations were found of either that the F was behaving in the core or the F as a band or any combination of it. Moreover, in some cases, it was such that for particular experiments on the system, the F core was giving a better agreement, and for particular experiments, the F band was giving agreement. But at least this established the following thing, is that there are two possibilities, the F band and the F core, and which was describing the delocalized or the localized behavior. So it was doing those two things, but it was extremely unsatisfactory with respect to the treatment of the F core. And also it had a question mark, a huge question mark. How do we go from F band to F core? How does the correlations enter in there? And that was a whole area with a huge question mark in a sort of general phase space. So the problem, there have been a lot of progress then since then, and the progress focused on that there is a better description of the localized states, which I will talk a bit about. And also, there's also a possibility now to go from the picture of delocalized states to localized states with the dynamocamine field. Now, the question, of course, now is the applicability of the dynamocamine field. Does it go all the way to LSDA? And here, does it all go all the way to the localized states? But the dynamocamine field then would take you from one to the other. So this is the way the localized states would be described. We are applying the self-interaction correction, and I will show now in the following view graphs a particular examples of localized states and how the self-interaction correction local density can describe it. The major points for this application is that the self-interaction correction is sizable for those F systems because they concern localized electrons, and when an electron is spending a lot of time on a particular atom, this self-interaction correction is sizable. There have been a lot of experiments on a lot of rare earth compounds, and those are to measure the equations of state, the pressure volume curves, and they have established that there are all sorts of anomalies in the pressure versus volume curve, and those have been associated with localization, delocalization transitions, and also sometimes structural changes. Now, if you apply the self-interaction correction, then we do make good agreement with those experiments. For example, take the cerium phosphide. There are two pressures measured, 90 and 150 kilobars, and calculations do show that the first pressure anomaly has to do with the localization, delocalization transition, and the second one with the structural transition of B1, B2. So there have been numerous more, and all established that there are localized states, and under pressure, they could be transformed into delocalized sort of states. Another area which emphasizes the localized states in the rare earths is the valency. Rare earth physicists, when they discuss a new compound or any compound, they always want to know what is the valency. Is it trivalent, divalent? In the atom, they are divalent. Mostly in the solid, they become trivalent. But what is the energy associated with it? The behavior of the cerium compounds and also elemental cerium is as follows: is that the dashed line is then the experimental results for the valency of the rare earth through the series. At the beginning of the series, all the rare earths here are mostly very much trivalent, but towards half filling, the europium and samarium, the samarium sulfide and the europium sulfide become divalent, and so does the europium. Then you have this huge jump here, and this has to do with filling up of the F shell, and then the picture repeats itself with the ytterbium and ytterbium compounds becoming divalent. The dots and the crosses refer to our calculations, and you see that those calculations do extremely well reproduce the experimental trend. So by just having a better theory of the localization of the F electron, one can calculate those energy differences between the variance valencies. Having calculated that, then we can easily calculate then the lattice constants, and that is then behavior of the lattice constants through the series comparison of experiments with theory, and it does well describe these anomalies here, and also the lanthanide contraction. Now, if you look at those energy differences in the rare earths and compare it with energy differences in actinides, one sees that the energy differences in the rare earths are much larger between the valency than in the actinides. The energy differences between the localized states, the configurations of the localized states in the actinides become smaller. They have also the tendency that they were becoming divalent towards the end of the series in the actinides, which is an agreement with experiment. But here in this region, also here at the beginning, the F electrons try to be delocalized. But in the region of plutonium and americium, things become very interesting. And to highlight the possibilities here in plutonium, I show in the next view graph, all the sort of possibilities of configurations we calculated of localized F electrons. The trivalent one is in our calculation the one with the lowest energy. Then not far separated from this is another configuration with one F electron less localized, and we can see that we can go all the way through all these configurations within 80 milliRydberg or so. So indicating, in comparison with the rare earths, that this picture of localized states, that we cannot sort of choose one anymore, that the ground state would be more complicated and could be more seen as a combination of those localized states, which is beyond our theory here, which is just a static theory and which does not allow to make those combinations, but it would indicate that you have to do a configuration interaction, which implicitly the dynamical mean field too does over those states. So this already gives us indications where one has to go beyond this localized picture. And another example is, okay, so then we come to this update of the Mickey Mouse picture, is that you would definitely go and apply the dynamical mean field theory when multiple configurations are present. And another example is the heavy fermion superconductor, not the one that Brian Maple mentioned a few days ago, but another famous one, the uranium, palladium, 2, aluminum, 3, which becomes magnetic and then superconducting. And our calculations do show that in this compound, the uranium has two localized F electrons, and now the physics here would have then to do with the superconductivity is indicated to be with the coupling of the localized and the delocalized states, and it also lies at the heart of the heavy fermion behavior. And so an update on this picture would then give them the following, that also dynamical mean field would be needed for the heavy fermion system again, because the remaining F electrons have been treated with the LDA. And in a similar way, for example, this scheme for localized states, when it describes the alpha gamma transition for the cerium compound, it would well describe the localized gamma phase, but would not describe as well the alpha phase. And there again, a dynamical mean field theory would be needed. So we from those calculations, localized, delocalized, one can see indications where to apply the dynamical mean field. And as shown by the work of Cotillard on the plutonium, this can now be done and has been done. And also with respect to the cerium work. Now, but this also gives now ourselves some hints of an alternative, a different way of implementing the dynamical mean field. And this is a strategy which we are the same thing about localization and delocalization also happens in IPCO, but that's another story. So our story, that our new strategy, which would be then, first of all, we would do then the self-interaction correction, and then identify all possible configurations over which we could do a KKR CPA, a mean field approximation. But first, we'll do a static mean field. So a static mean field correlation is only to start with, and over all possible configurations. And that would then form the starting point for either doing a dynamical KKR CPA. So we can now, with this dynamical CPA, we would have the freedom that for a state now. Previously, it was either localized or delocalized all of the time. Then in time, it could vary from localization to delocalization. And over those configurations, we could average. Or we could also use a dynamical mean field with the quantum Monte Carlo, where we would have good guesses on our one electron wave functions. And that would be our strategy to do material-specific many-body theory, which is a different way of looking at it.
OK. Well, I just heard that the peak is here. However, we have a couple more things that we wanted to do. So I'm going to be very brief. I wanted to mention a couple of things because it's exactly on the subject of this talk, which is, so I will just confine myself. Can you?
You should have arranged for a common laptop.
Yes. Thanks. I will confine myself to three view graphs.
That was nice.
Okay, so mine is here.
Okay. Okay, here we go.
Very good.
No, I have this.
No.
Okay. There's no signal. Shit.
Which one? Activate the screen.
How?
I don't know, like, I have a computer. I have F5. F5 or F6? F5. I think I can do it. I would say probably this.
F7. Yeah.
Okay.
Very good.
Okay, so I just wanted to continue on the line that Walter Temmerman started, that there are materials where we really need to take into account in the dynamical correlations and do a local configuration interaction, and such a material is plutonium, and Sergei Savrasov and myself have been looking at this problem already for quite a few years, and recently we sort of reached the conclusion that not just the electrons are important there, but we also need to take into account the phonons. So I just would like to say just a couple of words about that, because you all know that density functional theory predicts very nicely the phonon spectra of many materials. And this is extremely useful. If you want to find out what's in some pile of gook, if you're sort of interested in catalysis, one simple way is to do optical spectroscopy in the infrared spectrum, and each material has its unique fingerprint of infrared phonons. So it would be very nice to be able to predict. And people routinely do that with density functional theory. And this is by now what is a classic example of the successes that people have had in the past. This is through silicon, and you see how perfect the agreement is between the phonons in density functional theory and the phonons in experiment. There's really no difference. So you can really use this as a practical tool to identify compounds. That's as precise as the density functional theory is. So what I wanted to say is that this very nice success story for weakly correlated materials just does not work in systems where the Hubbard U is important. And that's where we've been trying to use dynamical mean field methods. And we, as an example, and what's missing really is the Hubbard U. And I'll give just two examples. One is in the case of nickel oxide, the reason why Sergei looked at nickel oxide is because it's a system where the phonon spectrum can be measured. And here we have the experimental points, and here we have the theoretical LDA curve, and you see that there are factors of two difference in the optical phonons, and that can be understood very easily why, because this system is really a charge transfer system, and you try to move things from the oxygen, which is when you try to make an optical excitation, you have to move the oxygen onto the nickel. And the LDA doesn't know that there is a Hubbard U, and therefore gives you a much softer phonon than an experiment. And these are DMFT calculations, which are really first principles calculations. So this is phonons computed within DMFT, and one sees that it really improves the situation a lot and can be really a first principle tool. Here we only use a Hubbard 1 kind of impurity solver, so this is really at the very, very beginning of development, and for other materials we need really other kinds of solvers.
Mostly the optical phonon as well.
That's correct, for a very good physical reason, that's the place where the Hubbard U really becomes very important. So now I want to say that we started to look at that because we tried to understand this element, which is plutonium, and I'm not going to give a talk here on plutonium. I will just say again that in plutonium, like Walter explained, is a system where the F electron is between being localized and delocalized, and if you want to really understand these six phases, we really need to understand the Hubbard U.
What's the meaning of the continuum maximum?
U alloy. And as you can understand, all these alloys have been made and have been studied very, very thoroughly. Okay, so And I will just give you the punchline of what's going on. We sort of, there's a deep connection in the MFT between spectra and volume, and if you do an LDA calculation, you really get too much binding because you don't have the Hubbard U. So you get one single minima and you get the volume at the wrong place. If you do an LDA plus U calculation, then you tend to get the correct experimental volume, but you still get just a single minima. If we do the MFT, then basically we get a very interesting double well minima structure, which can really explain many of the physical properties of plutonium. And that was enough to understand the delta phase. And then, so this is sort of something that was already alluded to, and also Richard Scaletter and Andy McMahon have carried out similar work on trying to understand cerium, which is a simpler system. But for plutonium, really, we need to do a little more. And if we want to understand, and there are two phases in plutonium which one really would like to understand. One is the delta phase, which is here, and one is the epsilon phase, which is a little bit above, which is the BCC phase. And what we're finding is if you really want to understand this phase transition, you really have to understand the phonons, because electronically, these two phases are nearly identical, and it's just the phonons which are completely different. So the message of my talk is that people in LDA have been saying that LDA can predict the phonons even when the gap is wrong. In reality, when we get to strongly correlated materials, I believe this is not the case, and we can see that in nickel oxide, and we are seeing that this is also very important to understand a prototypical system such as plutonium. And I have a lot more to say about this material. It's very dear to my heart, but we'll do it some other time. Okay, so this is sort of some little advertising of what dynamic amine field theory can do for F-electron systems. And then we have one more. Are there any questions on this? Okay, so if not, I think that people really want to get the pizza. So Vlad wanted to say also a couple of things. Just 2 minutes. And
I can try to say something in 5 minutes. I actually have only lunch in Spanish, so that...
Okay, that would be good. Because I can get rid of this now.
I think one time Thomas was on live, and he gave a talk, hours talk with three transparencies, so I'm trying to desperately to reach that level of quality. So I will be, let me be brief here since we're running out of time. I would like to say just a couple of messages here from my point of view, what I find exciting and interesting. And the first thing is that it's really very pleasant to see that these realistic methods that we have been developing can describe not only the electronic structure, but also correlations, in particular the MFT has been something of a new paradigm. But I would like to just say that from my personal point of view, and my research is somewhat tangential to this community because I mostly work on the solar systems, I find this kind of new way of thinking was very useful, not in terms of just getting good numbers. As we heard, it works pretty well for good numbers, but also it's a little bit different way of thinking what are the elementary excitations that we care about. In particular, you know, the reason why we know metals is because we have Fermi liquid theory, and below some energy, we have very simple fermionic excitations that we understand all too well. And this is great. But the problem is with some new materials, especially these oxides, correlated materials, and many other examples, you know, when you go to an experimentalist and say, well, my theory works at low energy, and they will always ask you, how low can you go? How low is that low energy? And most theorists, in fact, has been traditionally unable to answer that question. Okay, and that's, I felt, a big problem, because it may be that this Fermi liquid description maybe applies at zero temperature, but the temperature range is very small, and this is very generic. Okay, so I'm not going to say more about this, But the stuff that I actually particularly interested in is that many of these materials are actually close to the metal insulator condition. And the fact that they have a low energy scale makes them very vulnerable to impurities and dissolvents. So that seems to be a very generic feature of many materials. But the other side of the coin is that if you actually try to do some estimates, how low is the energy where the excitations are Fermi liquid-like or coherent, you'll see that it actually gets lower and lower when you put this order. And essentially, you have some kind of regime where the electron is really not coherent, not well described by simple elementary excitations. And this is where VMFT has been very successful, because it can describe, in fact, an incoherent regime in a quantitative terms. So you can do some calculations and tell to the experimentalist how low is the temperature where we should see a Fermi liquid. Or, in fact, what we find is for some disordered compounds which are sufficiently dirty, then this regime basically disappears. And we always have an incoherent behavior, but to be able to do this, we need tools to describe the incoherent electron, which is not really just a fermion, but it's a fermion interacting very strongly with some bosonic excitations. And so this is what has been sort of very exciting. Another feature of these disordered systems is that there are actually several competing processes that are important in the relevant temperature range or in the energy range. And in addition to the MOTS physics that we heard a lot about, there is also impurity physics, which has to do with the fact that impurities can actually bind electrons and form bound states, totally changing the wave functions. And that's something that we worked very hard to incorporate in the DMFT picture by making the self-energy still local, but site-dependent, so it's an inhomogeneous generalization, which can capture, as it turns out, the second process, which is very important. And it happens basically at the same scale. And finally, let me just say a few words about the third component that I feel is important once we have disorder-driven systems. And that's the fact that many of the ground states, many of these systems have competing ground states. So we have small energies between these competing ground states, typically. And so disorder can usually favor one or the other states. This is something that is believed is at the origin of these strong inhomogeneities in several systems like manganites, rutenates, perhaps the Lutin magnetic semiconductor systems. But there is more. I would like to say that there is more. And what is more is that not only that you can form some clusters which are static like this, if there are impurities which can stabilize some particular phase locally, but the important thing is that if you imagine that I'm lowering the temperature and there is a ground state which is the best, some kind of periodic ground state, like for example in the window glass you have a crystal, what is very important to recognize in the system is that you can generally have a very, very hard time reaching this ground state kinetically as we cool the system and prepare samples. And the system will very typically get stuck in some metastable state that is very, very far from the periodic order. And so you may have some dynamics which is closely related to this competition of different interactions, or which you may describe as frustration. This dynamics is highly non-trivial and can in fact dominate many problems. We have heard mentioned today by Antoine that, for example, in the underdog cuprates, there's now also evidence of clusters in strong homogeneities on the nanoscale. And it's very likely that some of these features are not really directly related to impurities, but are somehow a generic behavior where you fall out of equilibrium. We have, in fact, a surprising amount of similarity between totally different systems. Similar behavior has been recently seen in MOSFETs. And the particularly interesting feature of these inhomogeneities is not only that they are inhomogeneous and they so give rise to some kind of percolative transport, but as we cool down the system, they display some non-trivial dynamics in the sense that as we start cooling the system and these clusters form, they will have very slow motion or dynamics. It has to do with going from one to the other metastable state. And so this kind of glassy or relaxational dynamics is very different, and that's something that has not been studied, even though there is anecdotal evidence in many of these systems that systems are out of equilibrium. This has not been studied in great detail. There has been a recent study in our laboratory by Dragana Popovic, who looked at the time dependence of conductance in MOSFETs, and we see very dramatic evidence of some of such non-trivial dynamics. But what is really nice is that we can try to think in similar terms when we think about all these other processes, and as it turns out, recent work that we have done this, in fact, confirms that some rather straightforward extensions of this dynamical mean field description can be used to describe all these three different processes on the same level. And in particular, I think a very exciting direction for research would be experimentally and theoretically to look at metastability and hysteresis behavior, glassy dynamics in many of these oxides. And I think this is an area that's rapidly developing. We already have some experimental work, but I think there'll be a lot more, in particular noise measurements and noise dynamics. And I think we have now realized that we have a very well-defined theory route based on an extension of the non-communicable theory, which can presumably describe this behavior not only close to equilibrium, but also very far from equilibrium. So I think I can stop here, and thank you very much.
We're going to break up. There is, first, I would like to thank the ITP for making this wonderful workshop possible. And then we're going to break up, and there's going to be pizza. We can continue the discussions, all these very stimulating topics that were presented over pizza. Thank you.
The song. Two things. First of all, in addition to thanking the ITP, maybe also I'd like, all of us would like to thank the organizers of this wonderful conference for the incredible amount of work that that they've done for us. So. So there will be a entry of our group into the holiday party song competition, and this is a some lyrics which are set to the tune of Dinda Hokey Pokey.
And for those who don't know the tune, I have it on my laptop.
So I have the lyrics here, and you can get a copy, and we expect you to have them memorized by 1 or 2 o'clock this afternoon. Or you can bring it as a cheat sheet as well.